leave the house now. What's the matter?
My feet are killing me. Why didn't you tell me we needed oil before I went back for the gas, Sam?
Because I gave you a $50 bill and the gas was only $5. Maybe you come back, maybe you wouldn't. I couldn't take that chance, Angel.
Don't you trust me, Sam?
Trust you? The last time that I trusted a dame was in Paris in 1940. She said she was going out to get a bottle of wine. 2 hours later, the Germans marched into France.
Oh, I'm sorry, Sam.
Sorry, nothing. Give me my change.
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I am your host of this murder show, Jason Bishop, and invited to this manner of death is the man who lost all humor, Sam Stepanenko.
It's no mystery who I am. Hello.
And Trish Coughlin, giggling in the background there.
I am here. Sam has humor.
It's just been missing for a couple of weeks.
No, you just...
Oh, I have no sense of humor. None whatsoever.
he somehow, during this COVID thing, has just become dead inside. I've been stuck at home with my wife.
My goal is to become that cranky old man. I am well on my way. Thank you very much.
Nice. We come into your house and there's this outline and it's just says ha ha in the middle and it's like the murder of your humor.
Exactly.
And of course, is he here? Isn't he here? Jeff Omega?
Oh, hello.
Hiding in the walls as usual. Okay, this week we're going to be talking about Murder by Death from 1968, and this was a Jeff Omega recommendation, and not our first kind of mystery house movie that we've done. This is probably the most purest murder mystery as a comedy as well. I know Trish is probably gleefully happy about this one because her favorite movie is Clue, and this is at least second best.
It's got Eileen Brennan, who is in both this and Clue.
That's right. And
you know what? I actually rewatched Clue after watching Murder by Death, and I actually think I like Murder by Death more than Clue.
How dare you?
Well, I mean, I don't think this is going to be a surprise to Trish, but I wasn't very fond of Clue. Not overly fond of this movie either, but my whole audience at this point realizes me and comedy, it's a tenuous relationship.
Well, there's this, there's Clue, there's Haunted Honeymoon, which we have done. And they were like these big old house mysteries.
There's a lot of those
that were resurging in the 80s and late 70s.
Mm-hmm. Like this old dark house or something like that.
Yep.
Yeah, there's quite a few of them. And it's an Agatha Christie send-off. And of all those classic literary detectives, and that's something we will most likely be able to play with a little bit because these are comedic characters of famous literary detectives that have been invited to this house, I think under false pretenses, and it turns out to be a kind of locked manor mystery of a death that hasn't quite happened yet because the owner of this house thinks he's smarter than everybody else.
Mm. You know, quite a lot of this movie really made me think of like the Mad Magazine parody version of literary detectives.
Mm. That's actually a good analogy. Yeah. It does kind of feel like this might have been like inspired by a story in Mad Magazine or some other EC humor thing.
Mm-hmm. Especially the Harvey Kurtzman comic stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Kurtzman was what was coming to mind. Yeah. Much like we see trends now, and there's always spoofs, like when the horror movie was starting to see a resurgence in the 90s with Scream, and that started the Scary Movie franchise for almost a decade, where we got five of them. So whenever there's like a genre that starts peaking and then everybody starts doing them, inevitably the spoof comes along as well.
Yeah, this one feels like a better crafted spoof than a lot of those scary movie, superhero movie type of movies, though. Mm-hmm. Not another teen movie, because it's smart.
And, right? And rightfully so. This is based on a stage play by the great Neil Simon.
Yes, and that makes a big difference. I mean, when you look at like the Zucker Brothers, they did good parody, because with all the slapstick, there was a lot of subtle, intelligent parody as well. Whereas mm-hmm. I find that once we got past the Naked Gun movies, they kind of just went straight to stupid.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I found even like the first couple of scary movies, they tried. But I never, beyond the, like, that when you get to that really slapsticky, non sequitur type of humor, like the Police Squad movies were, those Naked Gun movies, I really enjoyed those because there's a story throughout them that I really like, and the Airplane movies I like as well. But more often than not, the more like Loaded Weapon and the Scary Movie franchise where they're just trying to throw a whole bunch of shit at you without reason for the most part. Yeah. Just go, hey, do you remember this thing? Here's our joke.
It's just you need a skeleton of a story mm-hmm. to go through the whole movie to make it work. Otherwise, it's just a series of sketches.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the Hot Shots in particular, where he uses the chicken gun or chicken arrow, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And that went beyond kind of witty parody to just like, here's a really stupid sight gag.
Yeah, there was another one that I hated.
Yeah, I think it helps that obviously the like Neil Simon writing this movie is presumably a fan of all of these like Agatha Christie, Dashiell Hammett type detective novels, and maybe coming from a literary position of skewering already is going to help, as opposed to a lot of those movies kind of just lean on, you know, like let's reshoot an iconic scene from a movie and then throw in some sight gags.
Yeah, you've nailed it on the head where this is, there's nothing I think wholly drawn from a particular movie or whatever. This is taking a genre of film and telling your own unique comedic story with it.
And mm-hmm. playing with the tropes quite a bit. And I enjoyed that. Like the switching room and the villain looking through the moose head. Like those were all like really famous tropes.
Yeah, and denying the secret passage.
Yeah.
Like yes. If there's no secret passages, says the cow on the wall. then how did you get in there, Truman Capote, the guy who looks like Truman Capote?
I forgot how unique his voice is.
I remember seeing the cast list and I'm like, well, that's gonna be interesting.
You know, yeah, apparently even his name, Lionel Twain, apparently is a joke based off of Lionel Model Trains, just based off of the way he speaks. His name's Lionel Twain. Ridiculous.
I never even thought about that, but yeah, I mean, I noticed a lot of the names are kind of puns themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Or Jessica least, Marbles.
Yeah.
Is Miss Marble.
Exactly. Sam Diamonds would be Sam Spade. Benson Mum was just a gag, so it was like, what's your name? Benson Mum. And a proper British gentleman would say Mum to a woman. Mum. So, a lady, and when he says it to another dude, they're like, are you taking the piss out of me? So, it's a subtle joke, but one that makes more sense to a British sensibility.
Or somebody familiar with British sensibility, yeah.
Yeah, and then you got the Charlie Chan character of Sidney Wang, and then his his adoptive son, Willy Wang.
Yeah.
He's the adoptive Japanese
son. That one I don't have to explain, do I?
No.
That's actually one thing I think we could address just right off the bat, the elephant in the room. I think that there's some people who might come in out of context and be maybe offended by Peter Sellers in this movie, but that character really is like, he's playing a caricature of a white man playing a caricature.
Yes, because famously the Charlie Chan movies of the 40s were played by Peter Lorre. So it was already a white dude playing an Asian character, something Hollywood was doing often. And his adoptive son was Asian in this movie, and this was a send-off of that genre, of that character in film. So it's not an appropriation gag. It is making fun of of the fact that that's how these characters were portrayed in those classic films for the Charlie Chan movies.
Yeah, about that.
I don't think we need to recycle that gag anymore because now it's so far into the past that people don't even know those movies exist anymore. So, and they're sensitive to that sort of thing. But because of that, that's an actual thing of those movies. You got to take that with a grain of salt. It's like, okay, yes, that's what this is for. It's to make fun of the fact that they were casting a white guy in an Asian role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it didn't make it any more comfortable to watch even knowing that.
No.
Mostly because it's really hard to watch that stereotype now.
Oh yeah, it was very stereotyped. It was super stereotyped.
It was,
but it's balanced by the fact that he has an Asian son who thinks it's all ridiculous.
And that, and the fact that not all of the jokes are at the expense of him being Asian either. No. Like, there's a lot of really good jokes and dialogue that he gets that is outside of everything.
Yeah, his fortune cookie wisdom is arguably, he is arguably the smartest guy in the room. Just talks like a weird fortune cookie Yoda.
Oh, see, the fortune cookie thing just, I found annoying as shit after about 10 minutes.
Well, some were good, some weren't.
I couldn't take it. It's like, no, you are Asian, but you can speak in a regular sentence. It works. It's fine.
Well, and that sets up the jokes from Twain as well, right? Use your prepositions.
Like, yes. See, I like that bit too, because it's like going, this is how you're writing Asian people.
You know, one thing I didn't realize either is, because this is actually one of the few movies that I watched twice before we recorded it, just because I thought it was pretty funny and there was a lot of jokes in it. And there's definitely other things to glean upon a second watch. But I didn't realize right at the very beginning of the movie, his son says something and he corrects his son on the way his son is talking. And then for the rest of the movie, it's everybody else is correcting him on the way he's talking. But he kind of sets the precedent at the beginning of the movie, which is kind of interesting.
I was going to say it's funny because it does show that he knows how to use the English language. I don't want to say correctly, but the way English people use it, but it's almost like it's a put on. And I think that goes back to the joke for the original Charlie Chan as well, is that this sort of broken English that is used by the character really isn't how he would speak. He does it as part of his act.
Especially because he's actually, it's revealed that he was adopted and raised in America.
Yeah, and that's part of where I was coming from with his character, is it's something to make his wealthy white clients feel comfortable. It's like, they're racist. If I don't do this, they won't give me the job.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting things that happened near the end of this movie that really dig into the characters they're based on and the tropes of the novels of their era. And that's certainly a fun one where it's like, okay, yeah, he's just playing into it. Yeah.
The screenplay really is. Like, I wouldn't mind reading the screenplay just by itself because it's very witty. It's very breezy, too.
Well, that's typical of a Neil Simon script. I mean, I think there's lots of good dialogue. It's funny how this movie, it's only 95 minutes, and you're like two-thirds away from the movie before the first murder happens, or the first death happens, or does it?
Yeah, because it's about character, right?
Yeah. I mean, God, first half hour, they're still arriving. And it's fine, because you're really kind of enjoying just seeing these characters and interacting, because they're arriving in pairs. You got the husband and wife, and you've got Chan and his adoptive son. You've got
Perrier.
Perrier, who is supposed to be Poirot, and his driver, which is James Cromwell in this movie.
And it was his first film role, too.
Yeah, first feature film role. He had done some television up to this point, but this was his first feature. Man, he went on to a stellar career for sure. You got Sam Spade and his assistant, and Sam Diamond in this movie, and those typical Sam Spade. He's always got the blonde bombshell assistant secretary. So that's the typical noirish type of detective. I love how he's constantly got his gun in his hand.
It's always the whole thing with like the lovelorn secretary.
Yeah.
And you can't quite figure out how the hell is she so lovelorn? And this one is sort of, I like how they sort of allude to the fact that he's just gay and he doesn't know.
Yeah. Either that or he's just like, well, yeah, he's like Mac and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. He's just super, super deeply closeted. And even to other stuff where he's like, he makes his partner turn around so he can cry.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
I love that bit.
Like, doesn't want to show anything other than super machismo manly, you know?
Yeah.
We got Miss Marbles and her nurse. So when they first come in, you figure the old lady in the chair is going to be Miss Marbles.
Yeah.
But no, it's the person pushing her. Well, my nurse got so old, I had to take care of her.
Well, I kind of assumed that when they talked about nurse, when I first watched this movie, I felt that like the nurse was like sort of the nursemaid that took care of Jessica Marbles when she was little. And mm-hmm. that's why she's so old.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's kind of
how I interpreted it as well. I would have thought it was funny, especially with all the quote unquote twists at the end, that it would have turned out that she really was Miss Marbles.
Yeah. There was so many going on. Everybody, they'd twist so many times, they'd wind up back where they started.
Yeah.
Like, literally, that actually happened with Sam Diamond. It was a twist on a twist on a twist. No, I was pretending to be this guy pretending to be Sam Diamond. So, you are Sam Diamond. Yes. Crazy stuff. Okay, I'm going to run the trailer for this movie, and then we're going to start really digging into Murder by Death.
About this. There's a number on the wall for all of us, Angel.
Neil Simon's Murder by Death. Meanwhile, a short, sinister man who looks exactly like Truman Capote is preparing a diabolical weekend for the greatest detectives in the world, Sidney Wang.
Don't I think, Pop? Perfect place for a murder.
Conversation like a television set on honeymoon. Unnecessary.
Dick and Dora Charleston.
Dear, would you walk now in the other way? My leg tends to look like a tree in this fog.
Sam Diamond.
I think we picked ourselves a queer bird, Angel. Anything else?
He has no pinkies.
No pinkies? Jimmy Twain has only got 8 fingers?
No, he's got 10. He just doesn't have any pinkies.
As we join them, our 5 clue persons and their faithful companions are trapped in a mysterious old mansion where a fiendishly ingenious crime is about to take place.
The victim is here at this very table at this very moment. And so too, ladies and gentlemen, is the murderer.
It's the most stupid theory I ever heard.
One of us is a mad killer and not to be trusted.
I hope he knows how to stop that thing.
Returning to the kitchen.
Who are you?
The blind butler encounters the dumb cook.
Oh, you must be the new kitchen maid.
And what has happened to the butler? The cook? Where's the cook?
2 minutes to midnight.
Gunshots, monsieur. Gunshots, Pop.
Gunshots, Sam.
Gunshots, Dickie.
I don't like it. I don't like it one bit.
I like it, but do not understand it.
That can only mean one thing. And I don't know what it is.
It means, are these 5 monumental minds any match for Murder by Death? Eileen Brennan, Truman Capote, James Coco. Peter Falk, Alec Guinness, Elsa Lanchester.
The murderer is...
David Niven, Peter Sellers, Maggie Smith, Nancy Walker, Estelle Winwood, and Myron. Who is the one who done it in the number one who done it? Neil Simon's new comedy, Murder by Death.
Should make exciting weekend.
All right, Murder by Death from 1976, written by the legendary Neil Simon of The Odd Couple, which became a major franchise, The Sunshine Boys, The Heartbreak Kid, and of course, we did Neil Simon's episode in 207.
Not that long ago, less than a year ago, we had The Out of Towners.
The Out of Towners, which we all adored, right?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I lived it. I didn't enjoy doing it.
No, I've come to this conclusion about Neil Simon. I appreciate what a good writer he is. Mm-hmm. I don't like what he does, though, because I did not like this movie either.
Yeah, I was crazy about this one either, so you might be onto something there. directed by David Moore, who probably had one of the easiest directing gigs ever with this all-star cast. Mm-hmm. And he mainly did a lot of episodes of Rhoda. That was a thing he did a ton of. And some of that cast made it into this movie. And there's the sequel to this movie, The Cheap Detective, in 1978, which he directed. And, of course, in between Murder by Death and Cheap Detective, The Sunshine Boys, which was another big film. So he had a pretty decent career. Starring Peter Falk as Sam Diamond, and most famous for being a TV detective of Columbo, but we actually did talk about him in, I'm not sure who we didn't talk about in this movie, episode 232.
Another huge ensemble cast. It's a mad world. Four mads.
There's four mads in that world.
I have to count them out of my fingers every time I say the name of that movie.
I actually wrote all four of them down so I wouldn't forget, and then I did it anyhow. So
it's funnier that way anyway. Alec Guinness was Benson Mum. And, of course, we've talked about Alec in all of our Star Wars episodes, 23, 123, and 223. Go look them up. We did them all 100 episodes apart, so you could easily find them. Peter Sellers was Sidney Wang, and most famous for his Pink Panther role. Not the only person in this movie who was from Pink Panther. And, of course, episode 155.
That was Casino Royale.
Again,
oh, yeah. Another
ensemble cast.
Eileen Brennan was Tess Skeffington, and she was in The Sting, The Last Picture Show, and, of course, Trish mentioned Clue. Truman Capote, who's mainly known to the world outside as a prolific novelist, made a rare screen appearance here, and he was the writer of Breakfast of Tiffany's. So Breakfast of Tiffany's is a classic, and interesting to see him here. I remember seeing him like on interview shows and stuff, so I knew he was a short, statured man who with a very interesting voice.
Yeah, you know, one thing I was thinking of watching this movie is, I don't need to tell a lot of people that Truman Capote also wrote In Cold Blood, which is kind of one of the first major pieces of nonfiction crime that was published. But I just picture watching this movie, you know, Truman Capote going up to people's houses and people in this small town where this murder happened, and then just asking them about murders, but also with that voice. Go, like, it's a strange picture.
Yes, indeed. James Coco was Milo Perrier in this movie. He was in The Man of La Mancha. And I finally got to put a picture to the Simpsons joke.
So you like donuts, eh?
Uh-huh.
Well, have all the donuts in the world!
More.
I don't understand it. James Coco went mad in 15 minutes.
You know, the donut machine? So, I was so happy. I'm like, oh, I get it. He's eating in this movie all the time. And I'm starting to wonder if that was just his thing in all the movies. Elsa Lancaster, or Lanchester, according to the trailer of this movie, was Jessica Marples. And we've talked about her a couple of times. Episode 152.
The Big Clock.
And most recently, like super recently, episode 252.
Blackbeard's Ghost.
That is correct.
Another one where we're exactly 100 episodes apart for some reason.
Weird.
I did not even think about that, but yes.
So we need to save Elsa for the next round of
Well, no, we've already blown it with this one.
Just in another thing.
And David Niven was Dick Charleston, and the Charlestons were based on Nick and Nora Charles from the Thin Man novel by Dashiell Hammett. And, of course, we've talked about him. He was also in Pink Panther, and he was also in episode 155, Casino Royale. Maggie Smith, most famous these days for being Professor McGonagall, Dame Maggie Smith at this point. Mm-hmm. We've talked about her before in episode 43.
Well, I didn't talk about her, but she was in Clash of the Titans. Mm.
Yes, some of us here talked about her.
You and Trish.
She was Athena, I think.
Yes, I do believe you're correct.
All I want to say is she was a fine-looking woman.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
still is. But
like classy, but I mean, like in a classy way. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not talking like just there's an elegance about her even back then.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
she was hilarious in this movie too.
Yeah, she was.
Nancy Walker was the maid, and she was one of the cast of Rhoda that I was talking about. Very prominent cast member of that television series. Did she do like those paper towel commercials too?
Oh,
was she like the quicker picker upper?
No, that was somebody different.
Okay, just that popped in my head that maybe
another
she did those.
Old redheaded lady.
Yes, it seemed to be the redheaded lady gig. Was that that gig? Estelle.
Oh, this entire movie is that redheaded lady gig.
That's true. You're right. Why weren't you in this movie?
I don't know. If we were making it, let's just cast me.
Okay. Estelle Winwood was the nurse, the old lady in the wheelchair. And I loved when I found this out. She was Aunt Hilda in the Batman 66 television series.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah, the one that that's Alfred crazy. Was always talking to. So that's fantastic. I was like, holy shit, that's who that is.
That's crazy.
Oh, that adds something new that we could do with this movie.
Right? A detective that didn't get used. Oh, I know somebody who lives in a cave.
No. She's Batman.
She could be Batman. James Cromwell was Marcel, and we talked about him last in episode 156.
He was the warden in One Longest Yard.
That's correct. And Richard Narita was Willie Wang. He was in Drop Dead Gorgeous. And believe it or not, Fay Wray makes a cameo as the screaming doorbell. It is, of course, just a voice sample, but there's a screaming doorbell of Fay Wray. And we have talked about Fay Wray before in episode 78, King Kong.
Can I just say, I want that doorbell. I want a screaming doorbell.
Well, you could. You can buy like programmable doorbells. So not hard.
Yeah, a screaming doorbell and a moaning face on the wall that tells you when dinner is ready.
Yep.
Yeah, well, that's an English thing. I don't know if anybody actually has dinner bells anymore. I mean, in my house, I'm the one who's making dinner, so I kind of know.
Yeah, well, I could use a dinner bell sometimes.
Well, you can I don't know, like the old farmland thing, the dinner bell you'd ring. It's time for the farmhands to come in. That long ago.
Now, this movie does spend a lot of time just introducing the characters as they're driving to this manor that's been specially prepared for them. There's one of the rooms is covered in cobwebs and dust, and it turns out to be all fake. Just add atmosphere. They've got rain machines outside the windows. I love that gag, actually. That was a fabulous gag where Wang comes in and is storming through the windows, but he goes, huh. But storm then only rain when inside.
And then you have the one point which is like, oh, Dickie, can you please get them to turn it off? And he goes outside, oh, no, it's actually really raining now, darling. Sorry.
At the very end, they're driving away. And he's like, it was all fake. Even the fog was fake.
Are
it
we sure the scorpion was dried ice.
And they look over and there's like a machine that's rocking back and forth, creating all of the fog.
Yeah. A decrepit machine.
Yep.
Like, and what if one of them wasn't? Because everybody was greeted by a gargoyle falling on top of them. Like, what if one of them actually didn't pay attention to the footprints that were marked on the ground?
Marcel didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Marcel got hit by the gargoyle.
Yeah, he did.
No, Sam Diamond did.
No. Marcel got hit by the gargoyle when he was there with Perrier, and Perrier's like, I told you to jump. Why didn't you jump?
Yes, that's correct. That was. And Sam Diamond did as well, because his blonde bombshell was said, hey, you know, you've killed Sam Diamond.
Oh, I thought that was a pretend thing, because he didn't actually.
It was. He wasn't in. He was fine.
You know, the whole movie, Sam Diamond, is basically just correcting people and then trying to explain how they're wrong, but every single thing that he presents is also wrong. Like, even at the end of the movie, he's like, I'm an actor, you're the real Sam Diamond. Like, he knew that that's wrong.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, obviously, like, it's really funny.
And then he has like the most ridiculous reasons for things where he's like, she says, why did you tell me you needed oil when you sent me to the gas station? He's like, I gave you $50. I didn't know if you'd come back with a change. I couldn't take that chance.
You will hear that clip at the end of this episode.
I loved that line when he was like, the last time I trust a woman was in 1940. She said she was going out for wine. And then 2 hours later, the Germans invaded France.
And that's what we opened the episode with.
That's so good.
It has no correlation. There's one gag that I kind of like, but I want an explanation for in our remake, is how the Charlestons always, always, always have a very nice martini in a martini glass with them at all times.
Guessing that plays off the trope of the Charles,
but even
from
while
the Thin Man.
Driving, he stopped to make a phone call. He's got a martini.
Well, that gag, they reuse that in Trailer Park Boys with the rum and coke. It's really, really funny, like this idea of a character who always has a drink in hand. And I think this is the earliest I've seen that gag in a movie. Yeah.
Well, in Sam Diamond, he's usually got his pistol in his hand for most of his scenes. At one point, he interrupts everybody just to stop them talking because he needs to go pee.
and he doesn't want to miss anything.
Yeah.
No. One of the things that I had trouble with is because I'm more familiar with Columbo than I was with this movie, is Sam Diamond is Columbo in the way he looks, the talks, everything, because it is.
Well, technically he's doing Sam Spade, which was made famous by Humphrey Bogart.
Yes, of course. Yeah. But then that kind of moved on to Columbo.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So, and that's why they seem very similar, is because Columbo was essentially Sam Spade all over again.
Yeah. But no, Columbo, and I got that, but it was really hard to make that disconnect watching this movie is what I was trying to get to.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
For me, I could make the distinction because Columbo is very sort of unassuming. Mm-hmm. Mark Ruffalo, he's like, oh, you know what? Like, I'm not a very smart guy, but can you answer me this one question? There's something that's been bothering me. And that's how Columbo solves crimes. But Sam Diamond just flies off the handle a little bit too often.
For the most part, Peter Falk just talks that way. You know, it's just a slight exaggeration on the way he already talks, I think.
Yeah, but it is. But I mean, like, Columbo was more like, he doesn't seem smart enough to solve the crime. Mm-hmm. And he also is asking these questions like, something's just not sitting right. Can maybe answer me this strange question? Like, you never know what he's going to pounce.
Yeah. No, that's where I thought this movie could really have some fun. Like, if you could switch it up to do more famous modern detectives. There's actually a scene that was cut in this movie that did appear in the TV presentation.
Yeah.
Which unfortunately wasn't in the version I watched. But as they're rolling away, leaving the house after learning that this has all been fakery throughout the thing, just so somebody could prove he's so smart. And there's another car rolling up to the house, and it's Sherlock Holmes and Watson.
Mm-hmm. I like that idea.
Well, you know what? It's funny. I do, but I don't, because Holmes wouldn't have been late.
Mm-hmm. Would he have been late in a comedy, though?
Well, would he have been late in a car?
And who's to say who's not now. Be the one, because this is all over. Maybe he's been invited for phase two, where a bunch of other detectives are starting to come up as they reset everything. I kind of like that idea.
Like he's able to deduce from the invitation that he doesn't need to show up until the very end, because that's when everything is going to happen.
Yeah.
See, that would have been funny.
Yeah, they're running through the explanations. I love Charlie Chan, who just goes straight to the trope of the butler did it. You know, the guy that died first.
Oh, also, let's not forget about how, like, I feel like Alec Guinness was really, really, really funny in this movie. And he kind of gets overlooked because everyone else is a famous detective. Mm-hmm. But Alec Guinness was great.
I almost feel like they stole the scenes he was in, because it was.
Yeah.
You're not used to seeing him in this role. Like, all I ever think about Alec Guinness at this point is Ben Kenobi. So not seeing him with the long hair and in their robes, and you just close your eyes and you hear the voice and you're like, oh shit. Because I didn't recognize him right away.
The bit of trivia about this is he was reading the script for Star Wars while he was making this movie.
Yes, this is just a year before. So this would have been the last thing he shot before Star Wars.
Like, I can't imagine what was going, like, you know, picturing yourself in Alec Guinness's life at that time. He's just making this absurdist comedy where he's pretending to be a blind man and everything that is ridiculous with that. And then when he's not doing a take. He's going back to his trailer and then reading about something that has what you call Wookiees and the Force. And it's like this gong show of a script. And Lucanus had an interesting life in 1975.
Yeah, he must have been, what is going on with this? My biggest scenes are with another character who can't talk or like there was a deaf mute maid who was supposed to cook, but every time he tried to tell her something, she just would sit and stare at him.
I almost wonder if Alec Guinness almost thought that Star Wars might have been a comedy just because of the context of also making this movie and how ridiculous the Star Wars script is.
Yeah, you might be right. I've been nice to see what was in his head during these two periods, these couple of years of his. And of course, his biggest hit would be Star Wars. And at the same time, I don't know how I'd feel as a senior actor, you know, a thespian of stage, and to be in your senior years nearing retirement and be famous for this sci-fi monk.
Yeah, I don't, it depends on your perspective of the world, I would think. Because, I mean, I'm sure there's, like, a couple of people, like, Christopher Lee loved the fact that, like, he was doing, like, heavy metal albums well into his 80s. Like,
true.
Mm-hmm. He loved being that sort of touchstone. And Alec Guinness wasn't too fond of this whole Ben Kenobi thing, but that was probably just his perception of how he wanted to be perceived. Like, if you're an old guy, it's really how you are, how you perceive the world. And you're like, oh, great, I'm, like, relevant with all these new young kids. I'm cool, like, I don't care. I'll just do whatever I want.
Clearly it was, because, I mean, he wasn't scared for this thing. I know Peter Sellers was.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, he did a lot of pranks on here, but he actually sold off his rights to make profit off of this movie, make points, thinking it was going to be a disaster, and it wasn't. I actually never did find out about the budget for it, but it went on to make like $32 million in the box office. So I can't imagine, I mean, single location for the most part and a stage set for the exteriors. So probably pretty cheap to make. I mean, it would have been a little cheaper if they didn't have to make the exterior set. But for the most part, now you're just really paying for the talents. I mean, there's some top tier talent here, but I mean, 76, they weren't getting the paychecks they get now.
Yeah,
well, and clearly they were getting it on points. I mean, a lot of Guinness did it because he liked the script.
Yeah,
period. Like, that's the only reason he did it, was because he liked the script. And I suspect a lot of them were, and agreed to do it probably for scale plus points, and Sellers was the outlier who sold off his points.
Yeah, and you had a couple of TV actors you could probably got pretty cheap. They were coming in his favors for the most part. James Mark Cromwell. Exposure. Yeah, James Cromwell came from television. Nancy Walker came from Rhoda, because she was working with the director there. Yeah, and Mary Tyler Moore.
I don't imagine the budget on this was particularly high for that reason.
Yeah.
Even all of the cars they were driving, I was reading, were loaned by a collector of old cars. So I don't even think they paid for the vehicles they were driving.
That's cool. I mean, I love seeing that. It kind of gave it this 40s feel, a little more authentic. And I did appreciate the outside stuff was staged, because it does kind of give it a little bit of a feel of a stage production, because it was at one point.
Well, and a 40s film that they're parodying as well.
Yeah.
Which that was stage stuff as well.
So, yeah, there's something about how it's presented that is really endearing, because it's a very classic way to do things.
Yeah. Like I said, it's a great script. It's well produced. So much of it was so dated and... so
oh, yeah, there's definitely
uncomfortable stuff to watch.
Like I said, the chance stuff is a bit cringy, but if you know where it's coming from, like, I get it. In 2020, it's really cringy to watch. And even that's Sam Diamond thing where, you know, oh, Lionel tried to pick me up at a gay bar. And that's coming from Tess, who's stating all this. So I'm like, well, you know, doing the gay joke in 2020.
Yeah, but he follows it up with a statement. He says, what's wrong with a guy wanting to wear a dress if he feels like wearing a dress?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, so it's
actually, at least progressive for 1976, yeah.
That's,
but really, I also love the fact that, like, after she tells everybody, he does the whole, he looks at her as, bitch.
Yeah, all of, Peter Falk was, I just really liked all of the characters in this movie, and there's a lot of really good, like, every single character had their own kind of, I don't know if you'd call it an arc, because no one really had an arc, but everyone kind of has the through line of their own story of what's happening to them through everything that's kind of not as much talked about, but you kind of see from everybody, including stuff like the Nick and Nora characters. Actually, that was one of my favorite jokes when Peter Sellers was like basically putting two and two together that he was having an affair.
Yeah, he's having an affair and he's broke.
And he's like, oh, I was wrong.
he's like, your
wife dyed her hair to blonde and then she dyed it back to red. Oh, wait, nothing.
He's a little shit disturbed with that one. Now, I felt like there's something we could play with here to make changes. I mean, we're going to have some fun with our casting. But I really like the meta reveal at the end where Truman reveals all of this as this elaborate plan. There's no actual murder that happened. I mean, it's ridiculous the maid was plastic. Mm-hmm. And he was posing as his own butler. Like, it's all ludicrous stuff. But when he talks about the tropes of these characters, that's when we finally treat these characters as, yes, you're fictional characters, and this is what I hate about your stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it kind of just ignores the fact that they're fictional characters. So I kind of want to play with that a little bit. I'm like, that's our secret, I think. That's the key to this movie.
Like when he talks about, it's like, you've introduced characters in the last 5 pages that weren't in the entire book. You didn't tell us evidence that would have really helped us solve it. You just hid it. It's like, you're cheating. So I cheated.
Yeah. So this is just like pure silliness on my part, but I was imagining it with 80s action stars. So you have Stallone, Schwarzenegger, Jean-Claude Van Damme as the Belgian. You can have Jackie Chan, Chuck Norris. You can have them sort of your 5 central characters. And make I fun of the whole 80s action Jean-Claude trope instead.
that would be fun.
Yeah, because I was trying to think about
those characters
reimagine.
Just react, right? Well, I was like instead of these characters being parodies of famous detectives, why can't we do it with their famous detectives? Most of them are in the public domain, with the exception of the Hammett stuff, and it's close. See, I would have to negotiate some rights there. But with Sam Spade and Nick and Nora Charles, but Charlie Chan's public domain, Poirot and Miss Marple are too, I do believe.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's a really good call too, because that's one thing that happens all the time with comic books is you can have the Cypher character that's supposed to be this character, but it will never have as much impact as if you get to use the actual property.
Mm-hmm. I think this movie would have been more successful if they just could have been the characters they were parodying. It doesn't matter, like, it's a comedy. You can still play those characters in a comedic way while still being true to those characters. Because it still did feel like those characters. And if they're playing into their own novel tropes in their characterization, that's even going to be better. Like, I kind of wish we did see Sherlock Holmes. I mean, we do have a modern iteration right now, so why not? We could modernize everybody. It would be funny. I would love to just throw that back in when they're coming back up, and it would be Benedict Cumberbatch driving up.
That's what I wanted.
Man. Yeah. That actually would be great.
Yeah, with Trish's idea of him just showing up at the end, because he knows that that's when he doesn't need to be there for all the clues, because he's already figured it out.
Sorry, Selvin.
Now, there was something else I noticed in this movie that I think would really work with our film, is the sidekicks are treated just like sidekicks in Trash. They're all treated horribly.
Yeah.
You know, the wife, the driver, the
adopted son.
Yeah.
And they're all treated like idiots. What if this is an elaborate plan on their part, as well as this host?
Yeah.
Going, we are the next generation. Move aside, you dumbasses.
It's Sherlock Holmes' smarter brother with Michael Caine, where Sherlock Holmes actually isn't smart.
Yes, I remember that one.
That was a good one.
Yeah, like I mean, like that idea where they're actually, they already know a bunch, or in some instances, the person they're with is just the mask that they're using to actually solve the murder.
Yeah, they're like pushing their famous counterparts to find, like, it's over here.
Well, Nora does that. Yes. She figures it out as the maid really early on.
Yeah, and they're ignored. So to work with those characters, and these characters that are quietly in the background are really the master detectives, and had just not been given any time to shine, because these guys like to be the superstars and they're getting their names in the paper and interviewed on television and whatnot. Well, I guess there wouldn't have been a television in the 40s, but, you know, they're getting novels written about them.
Yeah, because they have the charisma.
What would be weird? Mm-hmm. if they kind of clubbed together with like Lionel Twing because they figured these guys got too big for their britches.
So what if
like, this is your test and they all contributed to the $1 million? They're like, we just need to show you what
is there.
You are.
Well, outside of Sherlock Holmes, because I kind of want to keep that gag, but is there a famous detective that hasn't been used in this?
Well, I was actually thinking,
has a sidekick we can use as the mastermind for this.
So I was trying to think about, well, I mean, Sam can also pitch in too, because I know that Sam reads modern detective books. But I was trying to think of, you know, what are some modern literary detective characters that you could also include in addition to the other characters? And I mean, I couldn't think of a lot that were super, super, you know, in public consciousness the same way some of those characters were, other than, you know, Lisbeth Salinger from The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Spencer's a big one.
Spencer. Yeah.
And even Elvis Bosch is another good one. Bosch would be another good one.
Because there's a lot of modern detective characters, and you know, there is a modern tradition of people still, you know, people obviously still buy and read whodunits, and it's still a pretty big industry in terms of novels.
There's still a lot of famous, like, TV detectives as well, especially in the 70s and 80s.
Actually, my original idea was to basically do this, but with 70s TV detectives, but then I found out that there's a movie called Murder Can Hurt You, which came out in 1980, which was a made-for-TV response to this movie that basically is the same movie, but with 70s detectives from TV.
Oh, I gotta find that.
Me too. Apparently it's on YouTube. I just found out about it like 20 minutes before the podcast started, so kind of want to check
amazing.
It out.
What was it called again?
It's called Murder Can Hurt You.
Huh, that sounds good. But do they have Jessica Fletcher?
I think that they do have a Murder, She Wrote type character, and it looks like they also had Starsky and Hutch and like a Columbo and a Kolchak and
I wanted
a bunch
Charlie
of that stuff.
Angels and Cagney and Lacey. That would be fun.
Jim Rockford.
Yeah, I was thinking, Rockford. Yeah, you need Jim Rockford. I guess in modern days you could put Castle in there.
Who is the guy who was in the wheelchair?
Oh,
Lincoln Rhymes?
No, I think she's thinking of Perry
was
Mason.
Was it
Alice? Are you thinking Perry
Ironside?
Mason? Oh, Ironside, yeah. Yeah, because Perry Mason, really, he had other people do his detecting for him.
Yeah.
He was just a lawyer.
Oh, guys from Barney Miller.
Fish?
Yeah.
There's a lot of ways we could go with this, but I was thinking it's just like, okay, let's use these famous detectives. Like, to be honest, Nick and Nora Charles, I'd never heard of out of all these people that they were ciphers for. Nick and Nora Charles was one I didn't know.
I always had trouble sort of placing them as well because, I mean, I've never read the Thin Man series.
Mm-hmm.
And so
I've at least seen a Thin Man movie, so I'm like, oh, I had to look into it. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, no, it made a lot more sense because I had seen a Thin Man movie, but I just didn't make the connection. Like, that was part of the fun of the movie, was trying to figure out who they were supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And now they were the one I'm like, I don't know who that is.
And that was huge in the 40s and 50s. Yeah. I mean, the Thin Man, the original film, it did spawn a TV series, but the film is a masterpiece.
Well, the trivia, they said that Myrna Loy was actually offered the role of Dora Charleston, but she turned it down.
Yeah, she thought it would be ridiculous for Myrna Loy to play Myrna Loy.
you know what? Actually, to add on to that, I was also reading that the nurse character for Miss Marbles was originally supposed to be an Agatha Christie character played by Audrey Hepburn. But Audrey Hepburn said because Myrna Loy turned it down, she also wasn't interested.
That kind of sucks when you can't use, like, it would have been even better if you could have used the actors who are associated with these characters. And in some cases, I think some would have done it. But once the wagon train starts going, I think it'd be a lot looser there. I do have one in my cast who actually has played one of these characters very recently. But it was only because I couldn't think of
it.
I was trying to resist, and I'm like, oh, but that spectacular mustache. And he would do it in a heartbeat. He would do it in a heartbeat.
I did think of that too, but I was like, no, it's too close. And that mustache is very distracting for me.
I did. I tried so hard to cast somebody else, and I'm like, no, because he would do it.
He really would.
Just tell us already, Jay. No, I'll tell you later.
If you don't know by now, then you will never know.
Yeah, you don't know me. You don't know me at all if you can't figure that out.
All you have to do is watch for trailers out there right now.
Right? Yeah, the next one's coming.
You know what I would almost do? This is just a stray idea, but I was trying to think of, so, you know, with this movie, with Murder by Death, it's a well-worn story that a lot of people have done to death that maybe even in the 70s, people would, you know, roll their eyes at, and like, oh, another whodunit, old dark house type movie. But I was trying to think, what's that now? And that now might be, you know, the Icelandic, you know, detective stuff that was like so in vogue 5 years ago. Or like, you know, all those foreign detective, you know, they take place in the cold snow. And there's like, they're all super, super self-serious. Mm-hmm. I almost wonder if you'd want to try to play with something like that.
Well, I kind of wanted to do something almost patently ridiculous. Like, you were literally stripping these characters out of eras and mashing them together. It doesn't mm-hmm. make sense. It shouldn't make sense.
Yeah.
And that's where the fun should be. It's like, totally. Well, how am I here if you died like 50 years ago or whatever? Like, you throw Sherlock Holmes in a pre-industrial London in this movie with, I actually kind of love the idea of throwing Lisbeth Salinger in here yes. as the most modern version of.
mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and the most like, those
serious
are,
and broken of them all. Like, oh, here's this emo kid.
But she's the only one who can use the technology. She's like hacking into stuff and trying to figure out what that could be actually a yeah. fun bit.
Yeah, and pulling on the walls and going, yeah, well, yeah, they'd look at all the tech back here. That's yeah. why the rooms keep changing.
It's like, look at all the hidden cameras, guys. We're being watched at all times. Like, you don't have to have the moose on the wall. It's just cameras.
Yeah, what's yeah. a camera?
yeah. yeah, and yeah, I mean, and it could all be like holographic projections and shit, even if you wanted to, right? Instead of like switching rooms.
You could actually still play with that one gag where Sam Diamond pulls the gun on Lionel Twain, and he's just like, oh, it's just a mirror. Let's test that theory. And he's yeah. like, sometimes it doesn't work.
He's a sociopath, Sam Diamond.
yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love the idea of like keeping them in their ears, playing more with the meta contextual idea that's near the end of the film and playing it seriously. It's like, don't even try to explain it until the end. And maybe this is just all happening in a writer's head.
Oh, I have an idea.
Okay.
It's based on like all the texts and all the novels and all these things, everything they've said about these characters through the years is it's uploaded in the machine and they create like the AI of what this person is supposed to be. And then they project it.
Not a bad idea. Although I will say I'm very, very hesitant about it's like this new kind of twist ending that some movies are starting to have where it's all a computer game or it's all a simulation. No. Not a big fan of that.
Yeah, I've even seen a pretty recent cartoon on Netflix that did that. And now I don't know if that's even a surprise anymore because now I'm starting to expect something that out of the box. And it's like, maybe that's too much. Yeah.
So are you saying you're doing the it's all in a writer's head, it's all a dream?
Well, maybe. I mean, that's an idea. Throw more stuff at me.
I like the idea of it being like a writer, a really bad writer. Like he's so bad at it that he's just stealing everybody else's characters and trying to write them into something new, mm-hmm. which is what we're like. So some of these sort of weird sight gags come into play is because he's just not a good writer.
You know, because this is just a slapstick comedy, it could literally be aliens trying to figure out the murder mystery. Like, you know, stupid.
You could, I don't know if this would go too far.
I kind of like Sam's idea though.
Cause like, do you remember that movie Stranger Than Fiction with Will Ferrell?
Yes.
Like what if it was something like, you know, like, cause that movie, it was an author is writing a book and unwittingly what she writes happens, but the comedy absurd version yeah. of that, where they're real characters brought into the real world or something.
There is an actual story written by Stephen King in Nightmares and Dreamscapes where it is a like 1940s gumshoe detective who realizes he is just a character in a book. And they did that mm-hmm. episode and it has, William H. Macy, who plays the lead in that one. I mean, it would be kind of a comedic turn on that.
Yeah, I kind of like that too. Here's a thought. Man, we got a lot of good ideas here, actually. What if these characters are all dead? Like,
and this is like some kind of limbo or something.
This is the mystery, the house of mystery. You'll get that reference. And they are locked in limbo, trying to outsmart each other.
Oh, I love that.
It's actually a cool twist on it.
I love the idea of them driving away and then they just sort of drive right back into that opening scene.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that, Jay.
You wouldn't even need to, because I mean, with all of this, you don't need to like fully like say what everything is, but it could be limbo. It could even also be like a a character limbo, like, these are where the characters are when they're not being used.
Oh, yeah, I like that too.
I like that.
It's a very amazing stories, and it still works within what Sam and I were liking here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also like the idea of that, but what also could work with that is where these characters stay. What I also want to like introduce at certain points is where this is just like the case of blah, blah, blah that they had at a certain mm-hmm.
Maybe that's why like characters will come and go. Like, okay, they're leaving the mystery because they're being used again, and Sherlock's coming back because his show's off the air or whatever. You know?
Yeah, like, that's good.
Yeah. Because you could play with this whole, because like that is kind of this whole interesting thing of like, there's some people who would write like, oh, you know, when you write a character, if a whole bunch of people believes in a character, then effectively this character can exist in a spiritual realm. But if that's the case, then if everyone stops believing in something, I think Nietzsche said that, that's how a god dies, is if nobody believes in it anymore, mm-hmm. then that's how a god would truly die. But like kind of playing with these bigger ideas in an absurd context is kind of wacky and fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost feel like a Supernatural episode. I mean, seriously, it is, even though that's kind of what I'm watching right now.
When they had a mystery with Scooby-Doo?
Well, there's the Scooby-Doo, and then there's the one where they're trapped in the game show. There's all kinds of them. There's the whole concept of the prophet as a fiction writer.
Mm-hmm.
It's all kind of tying in really nicely, but it's something new as well. So I'm kind of liking all of these ideas.
But I do want, what was it? There's one thing I do want to sit on and stand on is I want at some point one of the characters to be like, it seems like murders happen everywhere I go.
Yeah.
Like they're just sad about it. They're like, why can't I be on a beach just vacationing?
I get a day off?
Yes.
Yeah. It's like that that whole thing years and years ago on the Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson, how he had that reoccurring Jessica Fletcher Murder, She Wrote sketch where it's like everywhere Jessica Fletcher goes, she's on vacation because she's not even supposed to be investigating. She just happens to be there when people are murdered, and it happens all the time.
Well, somebody made a point that Jessica Fletcher was actually the most prolific serial killer ever.
Yes.
I think that was me.
I think it was, yes. I was the one who floated the idea of a Jessica Fletcher Sherlock solve-off.
Because you could play around with the whole thing. Because with that, you would infer, if Jessica Fletcher was a serial killer, that, she's just really good at explaining things to make it seem like that's the explanation. But that's basically what Sam Diamond does this whole movie. Even when he knows he's wrong, he just offers an explanation because it might fit the solution. Like, that's a really fun thing for a detective character to do, is just, even if they're not being helpful, they're just offering suggestions mm-hmm. for things.
I love it when plausible. The David Niven character, Dick Charleston, when everybody's figured out that the rooms change, except for he wasn't in the room when it happened, so he's like, oh, I figured it out. It's like, yeah, we've already got that.
Yeah.
News, Dickie.
So, no, a lot of fun. Man, I think we got a working theory here. Like, the gags itself would take a lot more to write, and we'll leave that to the scripting stage when they remake this thing. But I think we got something really fun here. And this would be like Cabin in the Woods was to horror movies. This mm-hmm. love letter that just acknowledges everything within its genre, which kind of makes me want to change my director now. Yeah, this is, I think we've kind of got something, a love letter to the genre. Yeah. Now, your timing's got to be right, because detective movies, we don't get a lot of those anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's been relegated to television.
What's great about this is it's because it is just such like a non-realistic space. You can have a lot of fun with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the murder mystery itself is sort of secondary to just watching these people flail around trying to solve it.
Well, that is kind of the case with this movie as it is the murder and the mystery and everything really is like second place to just character study and interactions with each other.
Yeah, the murder is really not the point of the story. What if we moved it to a train?
That'd be fun, actually. I was thinking something like that.
Well, I'm just thinking because it's a nice throwback to one of our own episodes, actually, to Murder on the Orient Express. And that's not the only one that does that, right?
Yeah.
Where they do the murder on the train.
Well, then it becomes more Poirot story. But this could be fun. It starts out as the house thing. And as it gets more and more absurd, as we start realizing maybe this is some sort of writer's limbo for these characters, as they go into room, now you're on a train. And now you're going different settings from each of their most famous cases.
See, I like that. Yeah, and right, or like a little cabin, right? Because I think there's, I mean, I know there's some mysteries that take place in like small like cottages and stuff like that. So yeah, you could have a lot of fun with that changing.
You could
setting.
Also have fun with it too, where they end up into other realms, where they end up in Lisbeth Salander's area, just like, who the fuck are you?
Yeah, well, I mean, they would be going into each other's things, and this would be a great way to explore some of their darkest moments within their stories, or their failures or successes, or something deeply emotional to that character. Now, when you get to Elizabeth Salinger's, they're like, nope. We're not ready
back
for this.
On the train. Everyone back on the train.
Just she's shooting heroin in the corner. I don't like it.
Because you could easily have it. I mean, if we're already playing with a writer's limbo and everything anyway, you could also do something where they're all invited to solve a murder similarly to this movie, but their mode of transport is a train, and then somebody is murdered on the train on the way to the murder that they've all been invited to solve. But the destination they're going to, they're, you know, maybe not going to get to because they're in a limbo, and the limbo is the train.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
There's all sorts of stuff we can do here, and that's absurdist because now we've opened it up to this way. We can pretty much do whatever we want now.
Yeah, no, I like that. I was going to say, yeah, and having them go to their own sort of, or having people visit their universe, I could just see somebody like Nick Charleston or Dick Charleston, whatever his name is there, showing up at Sam Spade's office and going, this is your office? Right? Like, because it's that rundown.
Yeah, he's got the rundown trope or whatever.
He's going to take out the kerchief and put it on the chair before he even sits down.
Exactly. Yeah. You could have some anything. Of the... Again, smart site gags rather than just gags for the sake of gags.
Yeah, and I think we've agreed we're going to stick to the characters that they are rather than spoofs of the characters that we know they're supposed to be. So, yeah, no, I kind of like this. And these other characters will help each other get through some of their own traumas that maybe are always glazed over in the novels, where Lisbeth Salinger certainly has trauma all over her books, but none of these characters do because they just jump to the next mystery and the next mystery.
And I'd like to like dig into the whole like Sam Spade and like his lovelorn secretary thing. I would like kind of like the Charlestons to be like, come on, lady, have a little bit self-respect. He's not paying attention to you. Quit. Go live a life.
This is the man who's emotionally unavailable. Get over it.
Yes. We're here to help you.
Okay, well, we can go back to the sidekicks here because we had some ideas there, but maybe these sidekicks are there jailers to keep them here?
They could be.
I like that. I mean, we talked briefly about the fact that in a lot of these stories, the sidekick is the one who does really provide the sort of pieces that to solve the murders, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they almost get there with this movie, but they don't quite get there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'd like to lean more into that, is the fact that they really are the ones who do the work. And then it's just our detective who's like, oh, I see what you did there. And then
these are the characters who should be revealing the detective's truths, you know, the things that they're not confronting about themselves that are keeping them here in this limbo. And that's what these sidekicks should do, because they're the most attentive ones. They're the ones who see it all, but they see the person that the detective is trying to portray to the public and not realizing and suppressing in themselves. I mean, this sounds really serious, but it could still be in a fun movie. A fun movie doesn't necessarily have to ignore some serious topics.
Well, what I would do with that, because it's a comedy, is, you know, there's all of these ways in which they have to grow. And because all of them, you know, let's face it, are all, you know, pretty egotistical to be that kind of detective. You need to be full of yourself. But because it's a comedy, there's all of this expectation of growth, but they still can't get it. But at the end,
you know, that's a fairly easy setup, too. You could have a scene with just the sidekicks in a room together having drinks, because they're sidekicks, right? They don't necessarily have to be with our star detectives. They're like, they're relegated to their own little sitting room to have tea or drinks or whatever, and they start talking about these things like, did you know that Sam cries himself to sleep every night? Right?
Yeah, well, that character, he hates himself.
Exactly. And you like have Dickie saying, yeah, no, did you know that Dickie's impotent? Right? Like, you just have like fun little stuff like that.
Oh, right,
where they gossip.
Mm-hmm. You could do that as well, but they're like going, okay, yeah, you don't have to exhibit it, but it's like, God, you know, it took me forever for him to get that I was pointing out this one thing. That's definitely a clue. And they're like, yeah. Oh my God, isn't that so annoying?
Yeah, the nurse says Ms. Marple keeps stealing her medication.
Yes. She's been on oxycodone for like 10 years.
And that's why she seems so spacey. I love it. Yes. See, and that would be a really great way to sort of do all of that without having to make it like trying to work it into the interactions with the detectives. But then all of these psychics also are in the know, and you can sort of have these sort of nods and winks. And as a part of our reveal, you can have the sidekick sort of revealing these things that they've learned from the other sidekicks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, now it's become less about some mastermind trying to prove how smart he is. Because you don't necessarily need that, because they're both trying to do, they're doing that to each other already.
Yeah, but I think you need a nemesis.
Oh, yeah, you still need characters within the situation.
Yeah.
And why not pick a literary nemesis, like some famous one? Maybe that's why Sherlock Holmes is late to the party, because this is Moriarty. And yeah. He's like, what the hell? He should be here by now.
You know, you could have a thing, if we were going to go with the Limbo route, you could have a thing where, yeah, like they're on the train and somebody dies and they're all trying to figure out what it is. But that's just what happens when your character gets used again, is that, you know, you die in that place and then you show up on the train again when you're not used anymore. So it's like they're all trying to outdo each other, but they're actually like there isn't a murderer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. There's like the man on the train. I saw him when we were in London in 1867. It's like, yeah, of course you did. They're just reusing him.
You could even have the nemesis change, because I mean, they kind of do that at the end there where it goes from Benson Mum to Twain to the.
Yeah, he's everybody's nemesis.
Oh, you right, can go on Fully Stupid where the nemesis is actually Creative Block.
Mm-hmm.
I just keep doing the same stories. It's terrifying.
And often it is. It's just regurgitate story and change location.
Yep.
That was what kept these things going for years on years and years and years. Okay, well, we can keep going and going and going, but we have a large cast to recast here. Yeah. So we need to get to that. Sam, why don't you start us off with your cast? And this should be fun. I'm curious to see who's got what for this, because for an absurd comedy, this should be fun.
Yeah, and I went with the actors I know can do comedy, because, well, we want to lean into that a little bit. So I started with my Lionel Twain, and that was actually my toughest casting, because I wanted somebody who was sort of distinctive like Capote was, and that's a pretty tough one to find. But I'm like, you know what would be kind of fun would be Elijah Wood, because he just looks so distinctive. and he does have sort of a unique voice as well, so yes. I thought that'd be fun.
I could see it.
For my Milo Perrier, I was going to try and cast like a real Belgian actor. I'm like, no, you know what? Let's just lean into it a little bit. And I went with Jason Schwartzman. I thought he'd be a great Perrier.
Oh. That'd be good.
Nice. I actually did look into Belgian actors myself, but yeah. I wasn't finding what I wanted.
No, and I almost went with who you went with, Jay. Almost. But I'm like, no, you know what? I'm pretty sure somebody else will, so I won't.
Yeah.
For my Sam Diamond, I went with Jeffrey Dean Morgan. Again, just because I think he'd be really good at the gruff sort of
nice.
Misogynistic character. My Jessica Marbles is Sandra Bullock.
Nice.
My Dick Charleston is Daniel Craig. My Sydney Wang, I did go with a Chinese actor. I went with Stephen Chow.
Okay.
Nice.
Yeah, I thought you'd like that, Jay.
I do.
For my Tess Skeffington, I went with Leslie Mann.
Cool.
For my Benson Mum, I went with Patrick Stewart, because...
I like that better than mine.
For my Dora Charleston, I went with Cate Blanchett. For my Marcel, I went with a French actor by the name of Vincent Castle.
Mm-hmm.
My Willie, Trish, you're going to like this too.
Your Willie? What did you name your Willie? What was your Willie again?
Willie is Manny Jacinto.
What a nice. Weird name for your Willie.
Hey, you my know Willy, what? Yeah. It's a magnificent name for a Willie.
Yes, and I thought you'd like Manny in that role.
He's so good.
For the nurse, I went with Goldie Hawn, because I thought she really had a lot of fun playing that character, especially the line about the gas. I think she'd just have so much fun doing that.
Yeah.
Sicky poo.
Yes.
Sicky poo.
And then for my maid, I went with Parker Posey. I thought she'd be really great as sort of the ultimate villain.
I was looking at sinister-looking actresses for that part, too.
Yeah, but she does bad so well.
Yeah.
And then for my director, I hate this guy as an actor, but I really enjoy him as a director. I went with Ben Stiller. I think that he would have a lot of fun. I'm thinking about The Secret Life of Walter Mitty and what a great job he did with that.
Mm-hmm.
because I still think that was probably his strongest film I've ever seen in terms of sort of comedy drama. And I think that he could do that, pull that off for something like this as well with a big ensemble.
Nice. Good casting. Jeff, why don't you go next here?
All right, so I'm going to start at the bottom of the IMDb list and move up, just because that's the easiest way to keep track of all the characters here. But for my Willy, I did the thing. I was thinking of Ronnie Cheng, who is from, he was in The Daily Show, and he's just this hilarious Asian comedian who's also been in, I think he was in Crazy Rich Asians and a bunch of other stuff, but he's just hilarious, and he's just somebody who can be in a room and react to things and ad lib just as good as anyone else can. And that's kind of what that character more needs to be, is somebody who can react well. And even though they're not there as much, contribute a lot when they are there. So that's kind of what I was thinking for him. For, I didn't cast a Marcel. I was thinking for Sidney Wang, if we were going to do a Sidney Wang character again, I think the only way you could have an actor to play Sidney Wang would be to just have Michael Myers do it. And I think that there is still precedent for being able to kind of do things that are uncomfortable if it's done correctly, like in Tropic Thunder with Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too, and that's probably the only modern case of where casting a white guy in a black guy role worked, but it was part of the story as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I was thinking for Benson Mum, actually, Ian McKellen. Nice.
That's exactly who I cast too.
Oh, nice.
And that's who I was going to... I was a toss-up between Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen for me, but I...
Oh, like, they're good friends, so yeah. it works. It's nice to have them competing for the part.
It would be fun if they swapped out too, again, because you're in limbo. They could just swap out back and forth.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be funny, so gag, funny. Actually. It was like, wait, I'm the butler. No, you're not the butler. Yes, I am the butler.
Yeah, I was thinking for Dick Charleston, Bill Hader, just because I know that Bill Hader can play like a rich British snobby character pretty well. If you are going to do the thing where you just cast Americans as every nationality in this movie. I mean, they didn't really do that in the first one, but Bill Hader is always a favorite of mine for that. I was thinking for the Jessica Marbles to cast somebody from the first movie, different person, but cast Maggie Smith as Jessica Marbles.
Ooh. Oh, I made Maggie Smith the nurse.
Ah, nice. I was thinking for Sam Diamond, John Hamm, just because the Sam Spade kind of handsome, manly detective, you know, John Hamm is already kind of making a name for himself after, you know, post Mad Men, just playing roles that kind of skewer older lenses of masculinity anyway. Like even in Bad Times at El Royale, he kind of played a character who was playing into these older ideas of what a masculine, handsome man is. So he probably have fun with that kind of character.
He played a great episode of Toast of London where Toast had a crush on John Hamm. It's a wonderful episode. I recommend watching it.
I haven't gotten that far. Toast of London is great.
Yeah,
and speaking of Toast of London, my Milo Perrier, I cast Matt Berry.
Yes.
Oh, he would be good. Yes.
And am I missing anyone? I'm missing the Truman Capote character stand-in. This is tough because kind of like Truman Capote is like, it's stunt casting. It's like, hey, Truman Capote's in this. And people are like, oh, what? And can't think of who you would bring into a movie because it would almost have to be somebody outside of film. Like, you know what? Actually, you know what I would do is I would bring in Stephen King as that character in an acting role.
I read your mind. I almost knew you were going that way.
I almost did it myself, but he's not known for writing that kind of fiction. And I was trying to stick to that, but I'm like, do we have anybody on that level anymore? And I'm like, no, we don't. So Stephen King is, as far as the biggest literary name out there right now, he does make sense, and he's got a unique voice and presence to him. And he has written a couple detective novels, so...
He definitely has. I mean, Truman Capote, I don't even think, wrote through and through detective fiction.
No.
A lot of it was, nonfiction or, like, disturbing slice-of-life stuff. Or stuff like Breakfast at Tiffany's. But yeah, I think that about covers it for me.
Yeah, that's some good casting there. Hey, Trish, I know you're going to have a lot of comedy guys in yours, so give it to us.
Oh, and I was just going to say before I start, Stephen King, I think, would actually kind of really work because, like, the comedic stuff he did in Creepshow, I still really love.
And oh, yeah. And Stephen King actually is a great actor. Almost every cameo that he does, he's really good in. He's kind of, you need somebody, and I would argue that Truman Capote doesn't actually have this. You need somebody who's not necessarily an actor, but somebody who does have lots of screen charisma. And Stephen King does have that.
Yeah, and he's not afraid to ham it up.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He'll do what it takes, and he'll go for the laugh, too. Like, I mean, yeah. I think he's just a very...
And, you know, if you
good guy.
If you did have Stephen King in it, one other hallmark of old dark house movies is the pretense that the old dark house might be haunted. So you could, you know, aside from what we talked about, you could have something where the detectives are hired to figure out what the haunting is, but it's actually a person who is orchestrating it to do a murder. Because that's something that happens a lot in those movies.
What if
but
we
then
have
you could
him,
play with the horror aspects with Stephen King a little.
What if we have him like showing up at different ages? So like, because his son, Joe Hill, looks a lot like his dad. So if you could have them both in the movie playing the same character at different ages.
Yeah. Yeah, you could have the thing where the reveal at the end is that he like takes off a mask and it's like him, but he looks younger.
Yeah. It really was a Scooby-Doo ending, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I seem to have an imagining of Stephen King just in this back room, just riding this bike that's like blowing smoke and giving noises, like just this weird little machine that he's got going to try and make it sound haunted.
I mean, it sounds like we're just describing Stephen King's house.
Okay, Trish, give me your cast. Okay.
This is just in the order of when I could think of who could play these characters. So Perrier, I went with Patrick Bouchot. He's been in like a lot of television. He's an older actor, actually from Belgium, because I went and did like, oh, I'm just going to try and find a Belgium actor. And I just thought he'd be really good. Jessica Marbles, Olivia Colman. I think she would be great.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
Personifies that. And she's done a lot of comedy.
Yeah, no, like, she would not be afraid to do that at all.
at all. And for Wang, this is what I had an idea for, is I have Wang played by John Cho. And the whole point of it is he's like, I'm not even Chinese. I'm Korean. But it's the only Asian they knew.
Yeah, you could like even play into that a little more without like John Cho famously doesn't do any accents at all. Like other than, you know, you could totally flip the thing on its head.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like, yeah, no, this is what racism forced me to do. It's like, this is the only Asian they can recognize. So I thought that was the only way I could really get around it. For Diamond, I went with Hank Azaria.
Oh, nice.
I like his voice work, and I feel he could do like kind of the gruff character.
Yeah, I was kind of looking at voice actors for that role myself.
Absolutely. And like he could totally do the Peter Falk Columbo thing.
Yeah, or even like the Humphrey Bogart, Sam Spade thing.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. A lot of openings. For Dickie Charleston, I put Tom Hiddleston because I think that would be fun. Dora Charleston, Jodie Comer from Killing Eve. Because she just seems like kind of that young person, but I think she could do like high class too, and it would be really kind of interesting. Now for Lionel Twain, I didn't know. I know somebody, this actor, he can go big. He can just, yeah, he can like leave it all out there on the film. He's not afraid to take risks. And it, like, I just think he would totally do something different with this. Peter Dinklage. I think he would be an amazing Lionel Twain.
I actually consider Peter Dinklage as well. Yeah. He was on my list.
That's awesome. Cool. I like that. I didn't even consider him.
I thought, yes, once I came across him, I was like, oh my God. I almost thought of him actually as Diamond as well. I think he would make a good Sam Diamond.
Nice.
And then for Tess, I went with Anna Gasteyer, largely because when we did Reefer Madness, and she played like had that 40s character, like, oh my God, what are you doing? Like, she seems that person.
Nice.
So I think that would be good.
I do like that. She was actually one of my favorite parts of that.
Yeah, like she gets that type of acting. Benson Mum. Now this one, I didn't know where I was going with it. And he's had kind of a rough run, but I think you could still do this because it was sort of like a butler with a disability, and it would be Tim Curry because he now uses a wheelchair. And I was like, oh, you could have a wheelchair butler and he'd have a lot of fun with it.
You totally could.
He was actually one of the ones I was looking for, Twain as well.
Yeah. Because like, I love him in these big holdouts movies. And because I love Clue so much, I'm like, oh, he is the butler. He's the only butler that there ever will be for me.
So yeah, the reason I looked at him for Twain was because Twain doesn't have a lot of screen time. Yeah. So it wouldn't be too taxing to Curry after his stroke.
True.
Yeah, I know. Like he still does the occasional
voice acting gig.
Yeah.
But he's doing voiceover stuff. So thinking of you, Tim Curry. For Willy Wang, I went with Darren Barnett, who's a young actor who was on Never Have I Ever. That Netflix series, unless you've watched it. Like, I haven't seen him in much else, but he's like kind of the all-American kid, Asian kid. for Marcel, I went with Tom Hopper from Umbrella Academy because he's like a tall, big, imposing guy.
Yep.
Mm.
Like you want the maid. I went with Melissa McCarthy because
we were on the same wavelength a lot.
Trish. Yay. I was checking in. We were in the same. Hey, it's like this whole a universe we've created. We're on the same wavelength and we're creating these characters together.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, I decided not to, but that was especially after I cast Sandra Bullock. I'm like, oh, she does so well with Melissa McCarthy.
Yes.
I leaned into somebody who was a little bit older.
Yeah. Instead. Yeah. Well, it does make sense. And then for the director, because I liked his series that he did that's a little off the wall and different, Bobcat Goldthwait. I think he could capture this like multiverse type of idea that we're going for.
Wow, we really were on the same page a lot. Bobcat Goldthwait was also on my potential cast list.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Cast him in everything, people listening out there.
Yes. Or have him direct as much as possible because he's really good.
Nice. Oh, everybody's got a really good cast here. Okay, let's do mine. I'll start with my director. I wanted somebody who is known for doing ensemble casts and has done, and unfortunately it's been with mixed results, but Barry Sonnenfeld was my choice, although I think Joss Whedon would be really good now with the direction we've gone. But, you know, he's directed Get Shorty, Men in Black, and The Addams Family, the original film. So he's worked with gothic characters in a comedic way. With the Addams Family, so, and Get Shorty with the snappy banter.
Fun fact, with the animation stuff at the beginning of the original film, 1976, mm-hmm. Was done by Charles Addams.
Oh. Yeah, I was going to say, I can't believe that didn't come up yet. Because, yeah, Charles Addams is the best.
There we go. I set it up. Okay, for my cast, I did it in the order I came up with them, and I was casting more with the literary character in mind, so I had already in my mind kind of done away with the parodies and wanted to stick to the actual characters. So for Charlie Chan, I went with Benedict Wong from Doctor Strange.
Awesome.
And for the sidekick, instead of an adoptive son, I went with an adoptive daughter, and I went with Jamie Chung from The Gifted, Gotham, and most recently Lovecraft Country.
I haven't seen that yet. It's supposed to be really good, though.
Yeah, I've got that lined up to watch.
Yeah, it's in my queue as well. For Sam Spade, I was looking for somebody with that gravel, natural gravel in their voice. And I did go with the voice actor, but he's done lots of acting on his own. Will Arnett from Lego Batman and BoJack Horseman.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
And for Tess, his blonde bombshell sidekick, I felt like that's very much part of that character, and wanted somebody voluptuous, but still could do some action-y stuff if they wanted to, because I want the sidekicks to have a bigger presence. I went with Laura Vandervoort, who we actually talked about recently when we did the Rabid episode, and she was also in Jigsaw. For Benson Mum, as we already know, I went with Ian McKellen. For Lionel Twain, Toby Jones.
Well, there you go.
Good choice, yeah.
Once you say it out loud and you can kind of see it, it's like, okay, yeah. It's very similar, but
also
unlike Truman Capote. Yes. And unlike Truman Capote, he can act.
Yeah. Yeah.
For Miss Marple, this one I'm pretty proud of, actually. I'm like, yeah, she could actually play this part. Imelda Staunton from Harry Potter.
Yes.
You can see it.
I do. She's wearing the suit, the little pantsuit in my mind, like the little tweed stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I as soon as I thought about the character, I'm like, oh yeah, that chick who plays Umbridge. Like, yes, that's my Miss Marple. For the nurse, I went with Maggie Smith.
Nice.
For Nick and Nora Charles, I went with thinking proper British and always wearing the suits and stuff, and I was thinking Colin Firth from Kingsman.
Yeah, that'd be good.
And for Nora Charles, I went with Rebecca Ferguson from Mission Impossible movies. For Hercule Poirot, I couldn't resist, mainly because I know Kenneth Branagh would probably do it, even though he's already playing the part in more serious adaptations. I think he would do it in a heartbeat because he likes to play some parodies of himself sometimes, including in Harry Potter.
I was actually thinking that too. I was actually thinking that there is a possibility that we might live in a world where he himself might even remake this movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I would be right behind it if he was directing it as well.
Yeah.
Kenneth Branagh, if you're listening and you do a remake of this movie, there's one thing I need to see, and that's like Hercule Poirot's mustache, but like bedhead hair in the morning.
Oh, yeah. Put that in the sequel.
Yeah. Get rid of the whole toupee bit and make it about his mustache instead.
Mm. Yes. Now,
I love that he had this big, burly driver, and I just assumed, well, this guy's probably a bodyguard as well. So yeah. I wanted somebody big, imposing, and again, we're upping the sidekicks. I went with Henry Cavill for that part.
Nice.
And finally, for the maid that doesn't say anything, Christine Baranski. I was really proud of this because she kind of had the look I wanted, but she's mainly known for being in musicals.
Well,
so the idea that she's not speaking at all, like she's in Chicago, Mamma Mia, and Into the Woods.
She can do very physical stuff. Like she's also a dancer.
Yeah.
So that would really help with that part.
Yeah.
And don't forget she was in How the Grinch Stole Christmas too.
Oh yeah.
And Birdcage.
Yeah.
Wow, a lot of musicals.
Right? She's like so much of it was musical, so I love the irony of not being letting her speak.
Yeah.
And that's my cast. It took a while, but boy, it was fun. I was pretty happy with it when I came up with it. And I'm really digging it what everybody else came up with too, so it sounds like everybody else had a lot of fun as well.
It was funny because I was stressing out about casting. I'm like, oh, this is such a big cast. This is going to be so hard. But it all dropped into place really fast. I think, in all told, it took me about 15 minutes to do all my casting.
Oh, I wish.
Yeah, the only one that I challenged with was Twain. And then it was like dropped on all that wood. I'm like, oh, yeah, I like that. And that's and I still like it. But you all had really good choices, too. I love Toby Jones. I love Stephen King. I like the idea of it being another writer.
Mm-hmm. I tried, and I was like... In my mind, Stephen King wasn't working, but when I think about it, Truman Capote wasn't in the genre either. So, no, he'd be definitely the most famous writer of our day.
Well, and Truman Capote was sort of like, for his day, he was sort of like a personality that I remember him more as a personality than as a writer. He's like Kardashian level, but way back in the 60s and 70s.
He's like Warhol. It's like more about the persona rather than it was about the work they actually did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he definitely had a lot of presence in the media. And he didn't do a lot of acting, although when you read it, and it's like a rare appearance of Truman Capote. I'm like, look at his IMDb, I'm like, was it that rare? Didn't look like he turned down a gig.
as far as I know, and I could be wrong, but I think that he doesn't act as not himself in barely anything.
Mm-hmm.
So it might just be that he's in a lot of things as himself.
For the most part. Like he was on television a lot as himself. Yeah. I remember him showing up in a handful of those Dean Martin roasts back in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm. 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 Media horror.
Yeah, no, that's where I remember from because I watched a lot of those off of Amazon Prime when they were there. I was a big fan of the roasts back in when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. All right, well, man, good casts. We had some good ideas and another... Weird, honey, we've made it weirder, to be honest.
We've made it weirder. You know what? And it can almost be a series, the way that we've kind of constructed it.
Yeah, I think there'd be enough room for it. I'm trying to break the habit of turning it into the 10-episode minis. Because I don't want to make it too easy on the people who are already stealing our ideas.
Yeah.
True. But, okay, if they are stealing our ideas, there's two things. It has to be the bedhead mustache. And you know what? Just cast me as Jessica Marbles. Let's just do that then.
Well, how's your British accent?
I can work on it.
Okay.
I lived in London for a couple of years. It just takes me a while to get it back.
Okay. You're like me, or I can do the accent if I hear somebody doing it. But if you just ask me to do it on the spot, I can't do it.
You just sound like an idiot Canadian trying to do an English accent.
Yeah,
that's me.
Yeah,
that'd be right. I got stuck in an Irish accent once. That was not of my doing. I had a friend who had me going, and then we were out drinking, and then I woke up the next morning with a bunch of Australians. So I had no touchstone for Canadian.
That sometimes happens. I had a customer who went to Australia for like 1 week. And he came back with the thickest Australian accent. And it was pretty hilarious.
All I knew is like I had to answer the phone. I was like, good afternoon, Queensland Transport. Otherwise, people would just stop because they couldn't understand the weird accent.
Okay, that was fun. That was Murder by Death. And if you want us to do any more kind of noirish things, let us know on our social media at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and invasiontheremake@gmail.com if you want to email us your suggestions, your questions, your comments, and of course your fan challenges. I do have a little list of fan challenges to start scheduling at some point, but I'm always open for more. We'll get them out there when we can. We love the interaction, so keep sending us ideas of things to remake or even challenge us to do another comparison to something that's you're like, when are you going to do this? Well, it might be in the back of our minds, but if you want it to be on the forefront of our minds, maybe mention it and we might schedule it sooner rather than later. Yeah, don't be afraid to voice up your opinions and you never know. It could be the next episode of Invasion of the Remake. Another way you can help us out, though, is by telling your friends and family about the show and where to find us. We're in a ton of different places. You can start by dropping in on our Wix site, which has several links. Sam, what is the Wix site?
It is invasionoftheremake.wixsite.com/podcast. And there's a new page on there. It has a link to every single podcatcher I could find.
Holy crap. Well done, first, sir.
20+, I think.
So many. And that's there's probably a ton more yet. Just have to search it out on your favorite podcast provider, and I'm sure you will find a link to one of us, and make sure you subscribe to us while you're there. And of course, if you have a friend who's listening to us on YouTube and they're like, where the hell's our new episode? We're not dropping new episodes there anymore. We're going to relegate it to clips. So tell them and get them to switch over like the rest of humanity. And move over to a more convenient platform. And they have, like, if they don't have a phone or whatever and they like to listen to us on the computer, follow us on our social media. The links are there to our Libsyn page. You can stream it there. And most of these podcast providers have a web application as well. So we're just as easy to find, and it's a hell of a lot less of a pain in the ass than YouTube, because they're not going to insert a commercial every 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, sorry. No more YouTube, guys.
I can deal with that frickin' YouTube.
Yeah, no more. Yeah. No more frickin' YouTube. But hey, you can also support the show by buying some swag over at TeePublic. We got some cool shirts there. I Survived 31 Days of Horror, which, hey, it's not too far away anymore.
Uh-huh. I got my shirt. I'll post pictures one of these days because it's really comfy and it looks even better than I imagined.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I picked up a logo shirt. Just try them out. And it's soft. It's a very comfortable shirt. So I might have to order some more of our own swag. Got a couple of PPE masks now. I've got one of our logo. And I designed this one with a skull and a microphone. I've got three different versions of that. And Sam's got several designs up there as well. He designed the 31 Days of Horror shirts. And I'm that person you saw on that thing that one time.
Mm-hmm.
I did that one up there too, and we're going to have a new wave of public domain movie poster ones that are coming up that we've done episodes for, and Jeff's been hard at work making those shirts, so making those designs, and they're looking pretty sweet, so they'll look really good on a shirt, a poster, a magnet, a mug, or even a PPE mask, and you can get all of those things, a pillowcase.
You can get, yeah, there's just, the only limit is your imagination.
Yeah, and some of those look really cool on mugs. The podcaster skeleton or microphone ones look really cool as mugs.
Very cool. I got to still order a mug for myself because that did look spectacular on the mug. And you can just go to teepublic.com/user/invasion of the remake, and that's us. That's our store. And go check it out.
Invasion-the-of-the-remake, but yes.
Yeah, fuck you, TeePublic, for that confusion. But yes, put the dashes in the Invasion of the Remake.
I mentioned it because I tried to do it the proper way,
right?
And it didn't work. So invasion-the-of-the-. You know, put the dashes where the spaces would be.
Yes.
Yeah.
There you go.
Before we go, Jay, I just want to remind everybody that All the Horror is coming up again.
Yes, we got. Yeah, we got it. We're going to be part of the All the Horror again. We always do make October all about All the Horror, but we've got the crossover episodes coming as well, and All the Horror, big event all month long, where a new podcast will be dropping every day for the month of October. There'll be writings as well and artwork, so check it out. It's at the All the Horror 18 on Twitter, and they'll be making the regular announcements on which episodes are dropping where. We're definitely going to be part of that as well, and have some guests coming in with their own opinions on the movies we'll be covering. While we're doing all that, we'll also be watching our 31 Days of Horror movies all month long, and we will turn those into some specials at the end of October and the beginning of November, because we know you guys like to do it. But now we got like four people on the show, so I'm trying to figure out how we're going to do this and drop it. So we might do, you might actually get some bonus episodes that month. So rather than have us spread out the whole month, you might get like two episodes in 1 week for a couple of weeks.
Just to tighten it up a little bit.
Yeah. So I'm still trying to figure out how that's going to work. But so we might drop like our first and second weeks in 1 week and do it that way. So you get twice as much Invasion of the Remake.
Uh-huh.
Because we're wacky that way.
It's not enough that it's 31 Days of Horror. It's like the extra amount of time to tell you about it.
Yeah, but we still got another month of programming to get there. And so with horror coming up, you can guess that we're probably not going to do much horror between now and then, because it's going to be like 6 weeks of horror or more once we get to October. So for all our horror listeners, it's coming, but we're gonna have some fun before that with some different genres and things like that, and
some lighter fare.
You know, we're still feeling the effects of Martyrs after all, so we're shaking it off.
Yeah, and just saying this, like, speaking as experienced people who have done the 31 Days of Horror, I feel it's important to mention to our listeners, it's probably good to do a bit of a detox before you start the 31 Days of Horror.
It certainly is. And if you want to follow us while we're doing the 31 Days of Horror and do it with us, send us your list at the end of the month. We'll try to read a grip of them out during the specials. Our rules, you don't have to necessarily follow it. You can just watch 31 horror movies over 31 days if you want. But our rules, to make it interesting for us, is we have to watch 31 horror movies over 31 days that we've never seen before. Mm-hmm. So all of our specials, we never watched those movies in the past. So that's part of my personal challenge. It's not just watch Nightmare on Elm Street for the gazillionth time. No, we got to go find some stuff we've never seen before. And that could be no small feat sometimes, but there's no shortage in the genre. So we always have some fun, and some are good and some are not so good. So that's part of the fun as well.
It can also be hard, because you can get halfway through a movie and be like, oh, wait, I have seen this.
Yes.
I've seen so many.
And then you have to abort and start with another one. Because you can't count it.
It's so sad when that happens.
Every year you watch 31 movies you haven't seen before, but you also have to take into account, you know, the traditional movies that you watch every year around Halloween. So probably ends up being like 50 movies.
Oh yeah.
Plus movies we watch for the show if we've seen those already. Yeah. We do a lot of content, or we consume a lot of content during October.
Mm-hmm. No, it's quite a bit. All right. Well, that was Murder by Death from 1976. Thanks Jeff Omega for suggesting it. That was a fun one to do. I wasn't sure, because, man, that one was well-received, had a good box office, had a good rating. The higher the rating I see, like IMDb was 7.4 out of 10, and whenever I see a higher rating like that, I'm like, oh, fuck. Because every time we do a good movie, we get stuck. Like, yeah, how do we improve on something that's already pretty good? But me, I'm a harsh judge on comedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and remaking comedies these days is always such a challenge, just because our current movie climate is not super open to comedies that cost money.
Yes, comedies aren't super popular for film right now, but they're a little cheaper to make and make more money off of. And the way I see movies going right now, lower budget films to be released in theaters might be the way to go, because if this is our future for the next couple of years, then $200 million movie doesn't make a whole lot of sense to put out in theater anymore because they're not going to make their money back. Mm-hmm. Especially if some regions still have their movie theaters closed. The U.S. is still in really rough shape, so they don't. There's a lot of theaters closing there. That's one of your primary territories. And you know, we know how quick China was to shut things down as well. Mm-hmm. So that's your next big market. And if you can't get those two big markets, that's a whole lot of loss. And I'm sure a lot of people are going to be watching that Disney Plus model with Mulan right now to see how that does. And if that's successful, we could be looking at a whole different delivery system for these $200 million movies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Interesting times. We're going to watch that closely, and we'll see if my prediction comes true or not. But it's all going to depend on how that delivery works, whether other studios emulate it or not, and whether people are confident enough to flock back to the theaters in the first place. So,
or even drive-ins are starting to become a thing a little bit again. There's two now that are operating around Calgary.
That's great.
Is the High River one working?
Last I checked was a couple weeks ago, and they posted pictures of them like testing, like playing Force Awakens, I think. And so I think that as of now, it probably actually should be good to go. And the Telus Spark has also been doing drive-ins over there. They just project. We actually went to Mad Max Fury Road with full pyrotechnics and like people riding dirt bikes and stuff.
You're wild.
Yeah.
That's an experience. Awesome. That sounds like fun.
Yeah.
That could be. That's one thing I like. It's like the drive-in was dead. So to see this revive an old way to see movies that I thought was a fabulous way to see movies, that's cool. And doing something like that with the dirt bikes and stuff, that's even cooler.
That sounds like the William Castle spectacle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so check your regions and see if the drive-ins are back, because that could be another way to resuscitate films. But right now, I just don't see the money in a $200 million movie, and which kind of sucks for the guys who've got some completed and waiting to come out. But that could be a major shift away from the superhero genre that some people probably aren't willing to let go just yet, but that could kill that very expensive genre. But that also might mean Star Wars will move over to television, where they've had better success anyway with Mandalorian. So that could mean a shift on where things are told, or doing things more economically and cleverly. So you're telling a better story without as much of the action sequences, the big explosions and the big CGI and stuff. But we'll all have to wait and see. We're all in it together, and we'll all figure it out as it happens. But until then, I've been Jason.
I'm always Sam.
I continue to be Trish.
Now I always, and blah, blah. I always return as Jeff Omega.
And we are out of here.
Lionel Twain, you must really be Sam Diamond.
That's right, baby. I was in disguise, in disguise, in disguise. You work hard for $50 a day in this racket.
I guess that means we won't be seeing each other again, sir.
Well, that depends. I'll be around if you need me. All you gotta do is whistle. And you know how to whistle, don't you, baby?
Certainly. What do you mean?
All right, never mind. Forget it. You ruined it.